decolonizing my practice is an ongoing process of claiming my sense of self-worth. I don't say reclaiming, I say claiming, because honestly, I don't think I ever felt truly worthy of anything, any adjective like good or talented or successful or pretty, because all of these were defined by standards that just seemed so foreign and out of reach and yet mandatory for me.
This is for everyone who is far away from home but close to it at the same time. Diaspora Babes is the art you make, the art you love, and the arc of justice. We are brown, queer, struggling, thriving, too much, too loved, and too loving. My name is Amal, I'm a Yemeni-Lebanese artist currently living in Paris, and this is Diaspora Babes, love letters to myself and you. Dear Diaspora Babe, decolonize.
Hi all, so I'm publishing this late, and that's because I've been sick, you can definitely hear it on my voice. And also because like the flow just wasn't coming, I was having some really big blockages on different issues regarding decolonization, and it turns out I needed help from all of you, so thank you so much. You're going to be hearing voice messages from different Diaspora Babes who have very graciously recorded their thoughts and sent them to me, so thank you. And I'm hoping that the inclusion of multiple perspectives will present something greater and also more helpful than if it would have just been me speaking about my thoughts. So thank you to everyone and enjoy. On this episode, I'm going to try to give a range of thoughts on decolonization generally, and specifically on decolonizing your practice. I've gathered my thoughts, as well as thoughts from a variety of other sources, as well as voice messages from all of you. There will be contradictions more than consistency, but realizing we are expansive enough to hold contradictions and hold our oppositions in balance is more powerful than legislating consistency in the world. This is something that I may have brought up earlier, but I'm going to make really explicit now. I don't know everything. I think sometimes I might talk like I do, but that's my mannerism, not the actual truth. I don't have all the answers. And making this podcast, I'm going to be growing and learning in public. I'm probably going to say some fucked up or wrong shit at some point, and I would appreciate if y'all kept me accountable. This is, for me, a project of regularly making and sharing my work. Like many, I struggle with regularly sharing my work in public. I'm perpetually finishing projects, but using a ridiculously high standard of perfection as an excuse to not share my work. Babes, I think this is one of the ways we self-sabotage, by considering our work like never perfect enough, that it's never perfect enough to share, by holding ourselves to impossibly high standards that you're never able to meet, and having that sort of standard be what's necessary to share your work is unrealistic, and it's a way to keep yourself from sharing your ideas or refusing to be vulnerable. A specific issue is actually what led me to writing and creating this specific episode. I realized I couldn't draw from my imagination anymore. The realization was strange because I drew from my head throughout my childhood, throughout high school, and yet somewhere in my 4 years of undergraduate education, I realized that I really struggled to draw from my head, to draw from my imagination. Now, my college education gave me a lot of good shit. It gave me mentorship, guidance, money, coming from a working class background, entering the super privileged world of Williams College led me to an unknown world of resources, mobility, and possibility. It was the first place where I had encountered people who actually made their living through their creative work. That being said, I, like many other students of color on campus, sustained a lot of trauma and violence by going through an institution that has historically and still to this day educated the elite scions of wealthy US white people. Even white men until the 1960s. The school didn't accept women even until the 1970s. My academic institution taught me to value certain kinds of work. It taught me to value certain kinds of processes and ways of thinking. It taught me how to be critical. And I realized I need to learn how to turn the voice of criticism off because it was stifling my practice. And all of this college stuff is really just the icing on the cake of the bullshit that comes from global imperialism, cultural genocide, diaspora and displacement, economic inequality, and racism. So this leads me to this third episode where I'm exploring what it might mean to decolonize your practice. First, I want to look a little closer into what it means to decolonize. Decolonization is a term that gets thrown around a lot. In academia, especially in specific departments like women's gender and sexuality studies or cultural theory, everything is decolonial. Your paper, your art, even the way you shit is decolonial. The term has become relatively popular and trendy, leading some to fear that we're actually out of touch with what it means to decolonize. In our eagerness to think of ways to decolonize collectively, the widespread brainstorming naturally produces some misfires, some ideas about decolonizing that aren't as effective or are out of touch with historical material decolonization efforts. When everyone gets together to brainstorm ideas, you get incredible inspiration, as well as false starts and ideas that don't resonate with everyone or need to be discarded or built upon or changed to be more effective. So to ground our decolonial endeavors in the motion of history, I want to share some posts from Dog Lover on Instagram. Decolonization is a violent process of self-making by the hands of the oppressed. Decolonization is armed struggle. Decolonization is community self-defense. Decolonization is direct action. Decolonization is not your vegan cookbook. Decolonization is a historical process. Decolonization is not the appropriation of indigenous cultures. Decolonization is the destruction of the colonial world and all its modes of violence. End quote. Lest we forget, decolonization is the Haitian Revolution. Haiti just celebrated its Independence Day on January 1st. Decolonization is the Algerian War, where the French thought it would be chill to just murder more than 1 million Algerians in the 1960s. Decolonization is the Great March of Return in Gaza. Fanon writes in The Wretched of the Earth, "Decolonization, which sets out to change the order of the world, is clearly an agenda for total disorder." To disorder, disorder. Dis, a Latin prefix meaning apart, asunder, away, or utterly, or having a private negative or reversing force, to the order of power. Dog Lover also quotes Fanon, saying, "Challenging the colonial world is not a rational confrontation of viewpoints. It is not a discourse on the universal, but the impassioned claim by the colonized that their world is fundamentally different. The work of the colonized is to imagine every possible method for annihilating the colonist." Every possible method. And I think that every possible method is important. That's something I'm going to cling to for later in this exploration. We can take steps to decolonize on the macro and the micro level. I think important changes happen on large and small scale, on a personal level, on a community level, a national level, a global level. Even in the case of armed struggle, there is work to do after the battle is fought. As we see in the examples I mentioned earlier, like Haiti and Algeria, colonization affects all parts of life, so I think it's important to think about doing the work in all aspects of our lives. Our imaginations, our support systems, our creations, our art practices. Not everyone can or should be a soldier, and bringing decolonization into whatever you're doing is important. Together, we span many roles in society, our lives touching many others, and decolonization on a personal level can initiate a ripple effect.
For me, and I don't know for others, or just like my opinion on the subject, I feel like it's kind of staying on like official academic definition to use the word decolonization when it's about war and revolution, because it's like kind of like the main big things and stuff, whereas to me, like colonization just as decolonization is as strong on the minds than on the lands of the people. So it's like, even like, I feel like decolonization is even more important on not talking about war and revolution, but more like how strong it is anchored in our minds, in the way we behave, in the way we think, the way we socialize with others, more than kind of like official stuff like wars and etc. Also, I feel like focusing on war and revolution is more like, yeah, official and stuff. And also thinking decolonization with like white people in the middle of the subject more than anything, whereas like decolonization of the mind, decolonization of ourselves is really like focused more on POC, more than the relationship that we have with white people. That's how I see those stuff and feel it. So I don't know what you think about it, and kind of curious to know about it, and super curious to hear about this next episode of your podcast.
Liberation movement doesn't just tolerate, but requires a diversity of methods. Adrienne Marie Brown, one of the co-hosts of the End of the World podcast, who is an absolute goddess of liberation work, black feminism, and justice through imaginative practices, says in her book Emergent Strategy, "Uprisings and resistance and mass movements require a tolerance of messiness, a tolerance of many, many paths being walked at once." So in this spirit, I've included the voices of other diaspora babes on what decolonizing the practice means to them. I've already included multiple perspectives on what decolonizing has and can look like, sound like, and feel like. Besides gathering voices from allied diaspora babes, I've assembled a list of actions I think are important for decolonizing your practice. Adrienne Marie Brown offers more guiding wisdom here. I quote, "We are always practicing something. Without intention, we are usually practicing what the dominant society wants us to practice, competing with each other to be cogs in a system that benefits the owning class, vaguely religious, vaguely patriotic." End quote. I thought this was incredibly important because it allowed me to look at the ways in my daily life that I was perpetuating colonial structures that had been imposed upon me. Intention, consideration, is such a potent tool because it allows you to start to distinguish yourselves from the narrow pegs you've been raised to call home, to separate the vision of yourself you have from the vision that's been imposed on you. The points I've compiled are concrete actions to take, guided by the intention of decolonization. Have you noticed how I'm focusing on practice, on personal practice? Talking about decolonizing art institutions is not something I'm going to be doing here. I might talk about that later, but personally, I don't really think you can decolonize colonial institutions. The modern museum, as we know it, is a colonial invention. It was started in the Victorian age, where wealthy Europeans would assemble vast collections of items that they had taken and stolen from around the world and compile them, divorced from their original context, as a way to show their power over the world. So how are you going to decolonize a museum? Give back all of the stolen items? If you do that, there's not going to be much of a museum. So this is a whole other can of worms. So I'm going to leave that for now. And, you know, just say to clarify, I'm talking about decolonizing your personal practice. Now, the suggestions I offer aren't alternatives or replacements to supporting the return of stolen lands, demilitarization, legal changes, etc., etc. That being said, I've outlined 5 actions you can take for decolonizing your creative practice.
Hey, diaspora babes. So I wanted to chime in and say what decolonizing my practice means to me. And I've done a lot of thinking about this. As of late with the start of the new year, but decolonizing my practice means to me essentially getting past the binaries and the borders imposed by institutionalized language. It means not focusing all of my efforts on reacting to institutions. And it means having flexibility and flowing and responding mindfully, and not making oppressive systems take up all of my mental energy or my first mental reference.
The first action, reclaim your vision. As I said before, I realized there was a really big issue when I couldn't draw from my head anymore. What happened to my imagination? All the practice I had done for classes, drawing from life, had done something to me. Now, I love drawing from life. It's something I really value. I value grace, not like the sort of thing that we usually consider grace, which is an imposed sort of manicured elegance, but the sort of grace that comes from something just existing, a plant, a tree, a bird, the way that nature moves or exists just as it is. It's something that's incredibly inspiring to me. And I think that's one of the reasons I love photography so much, is because it allows me to be present in the action of the moment, in the energy of the moment. And so drawing from life is something that I really value and is really important in my practice. That being said, there's a sort of violence that comes from only being able to see what's in front of you, especially when that ability is imposed in a institution like the college I attended that is completely dominated by rich white people. You're isolated and you forget that the rest of the world exists. And so when you're confined to the reality that is around us, which is white supremacist, there's an issue, and the issue is that of vision. Whenever I would sit down to draw from my imagination, I was blocked by all of the criticisms that came from my head in the form of voices from all of my professors, as well as just stuff that I had picked up, you know, along the way, like, oh, this is so ugly, this is like disproportional, this is bullshit, wow, you can do that so much better, like. And so I've developed this practice of just drawing without judging, of just kind of like laying things out on the page while turning off the critical part of my brain, like turning off the part of my brain that's imposing and or talking and just being. If you have some sort of meditative practice like yoga or running or just anything that, you know, you get where you get lost in, not lost, but totally absorbed in the action rather, in the being, in the physical presence of your body and your body's reality. That's something that I think is really important to lean into. Drawing without judging has been part of my practice for recovering my drawing and painting practice, for recovering my vision, making marks without judgment. I warm up most days by painting whatever I want, often abstract brushstrokes. I actually started doing this on a book that I found in the trash that was a compilation of abstract paintings by French artists. It was one of these contemporary art fairs where they gathered a bunch of paintings and published it in a book, and I found it in the trash. So I've just been like painting over that as part of my own like gesture towards reclaiming my vision from European domination. So that's one of the methods that I've used personally. So yeah, like identifying your inner critic or your inner colonizer, identifying that it's there and finding ways to subvert it.
I don't know if any of that makes sense, but it's something I'm like working on, and maybe it's gonna spark some ideas for you all, and you can tell me what reclaiming your vision means to you.
To be honest, I don't think I make any particular effort to decolonize my art. I make the art and then I look at it and I'm like, I wonder where that came from. And that's kind of the, I don't know. That's kind of the extent of my artistic process, really. For me, I don't take my art too seriously. I don't view it as a commentary or as a rebuttal or as a response to anything in particular. For me, it's more of a cathartic process, letting go. And I suppose allowing myself the space to let go. is therapeutic in itself, and I kind of don't question it or theorize it.
Diversify whose work you consume.
I started this because I realized I was watching almost all films by white men, and I was like, wait, what the fuck? Like, this is why the Adrienne Marie Brown quotation about intention was so important to me, because it's not like I was out here trying to just watch films by white men, but that's just, you know, the dominant reality that we live in. And so because I wasn't being intentional about what I was consuming, I was eating off of a steady diet of white supremacy. Here's what I suggest. Make a list of all of your favorite works of art. Make a list of what inspires you. And then look at who made it on the list. This will tell you a lot about yourself and what you like. Whatever it is you consume, whether it's podcasts, YouTube, TV series, movies, books, be conscious with who you're engaging with. Be intentional about making sure that you're watching or listening to or reading stuff by people of color. If it's not readily available, do the work of finding alternatives. I actually got called out by my ex for only using white yoga teachers on YouTube. I think I had told her something like, yeah, it's this white girl, Adria, she really helps me, like, I feel bad about it, but you know, like, she's really good. And she's like, come on, there's like no one else on YouTube. And I was like, no. No one that I had known. And then I had to put in the work and find some quality like black and brown yoga instructors on YouTube, and that's who I primarily try to practice with now. If you watch YouTube, are the YouTubers women and people of color? Of the podcasts you listen to, how many of them are made by white men? Make it an active choice to incorporate POC and women into the art you consume. For all of this, being intentional and aware of is huge. So like, no, you're not going to switch to consuming all work by POC tomorrow, but incorporating it into your diet is important. Like, if you're eating meat every day, you won't become vegetarian or vegan tomorrow, but reducing your meat intake and your animal product intake is a step in the right direction. And it's not that you can consume any art by white people or you're not allowed to like it. No, go ahead. But just make sure that you're not like exclusively imbibing and internalizing narratives by the colonizer. That's it.
I think we should decolonize everything that we were forced to change under European colonialism and occupation, and that includes our language, our bodies, and our art, and how we see ourselves, and how we see ourselves and how we see others like us is heavily influenced by art. And that's what I think decolonization means to me. That it's reclaiming my body and my culture and myself and my parents and my grandparents and all of my ancestors that were changed under any type of colonialism or gentrification by white Christian society. And I think it's beautiful and it should be applied to art.
Claim your lineage. This is who you're in conversation with, even if they're dead. Who are you in dialogue with? Who is responding to your work? Claiming your role in a lineage of other POC and racialized people working against oppression or working within whatever field you're working in is incredibly important. Yeah, cite people. Where are you getting your ideas? There are so many black and brown people, especially women and queers, who innovate and create ideas and then have someone else take credit for the idea. And the other person is then the one that cited all of the time. For example, you know, this is just a pretty random example. There's so many more examples in, you know, more contemporary settings. But if you know the Rider-Waite tarot deck, which is probably the best known tarot imagery, or the so-called Rider-Waite deck, the artist was actually Pamela Coleman Smith, who is a woman of color artist who was probably queer. A lot of the circumstances surrounding her
are really mysterious because she was almost erased from history. So that's just one of the examples where a woman of color like has innovated something that goes on to be super influential and well known, and it's not known because she's not cited. And a lot of that erasure is due to like white folks and the colonizer, but I think a lot of us have also been trained to not cite our influences and to think that our ideas are less. But I think a lot of us have also been trained to not cite where our ideas are coming from. This is one of the capitalist things that's all about like competition, right? The idea that we have to compete with other people for our ideas to be seen and stuff like that, which is again like a super scarcity sort of mindset. And I think that part of claiming your lineage is making the shift from thinking that your ideas are less valuable because you share them with other people, or your ideas are less valuable because you got inspiration from some other people. We're all like, you know, inspiring each other all the time and getting influences from people. A lot of the ideas that you've had, like someone else has probably also had ideas too. You know, it's that whole thing with that comes up so many times in history where people are credited for ideas, and then there's like someone else who's like, well, this other person had the idea around the same time. I think there was some issue with Thomas Edison and that. And it's true, like I think a lot of inspiration, you know, I said this in one of my other episodes, like inspiration comes through artists. It doesn't necessarily come from them, I think. So getting used to citing other people, I think, is huge for kind of deconstructing the sort of systems of hierarchy and oppression that we have like internalized. This is a huge thing in academia, like the number of papers that I've read that are supposed to be doing post-colonial analysis, and then they start off by citing Derrida and deconstructing Foucault, like... Where are the POC that you're citing? Adrienne Marie Brown is huge on citing the influences of her work in the book Emergent Strategies. And I'm so struck by the care and attention, the love that she puts into noting where all the words come from, the ideas, the people, the times, the places, and it all makes the message of the book so much richer. One of the things in academia is, yeah, name dropping like white people so that you're taken seriously. And like, I get that, but also can we move away from the circle jerk of always citing continental philosophers? I think the mirror image of claiming your lineage is defining your audience. For example, professors in my art department would always push me to make white people my audience. Like they would never say it that way, but there was always this insistence on making the work legible to the white. It was a huge challenge for me specifically because I was trying to make work that had to do specifically with like my Muslim upbringing and with the super immigrant, like South Asian and Arab populations in the town where I grew up. And all they wanted to know was like, you know, people aren't going to get this. And I was like, okay, well, maybe you won't get this, but my people are going to get this. If you're always making work that's directed towards white people, I think that you might want to shift your assumptions. Reparations. This is the next thing that I've kind of thought about for decolonizing your practice. I'm mainly addressing this one for people who live in the US, just because that's where I know the context best. If you're a white person, you should be paying reparations. If you're a POC who isn't black or indigenous, especially if you're really light or white passing or have a parent who is white, you should probably consider paying too. I'm including POC in this because we actively benefit from anti-blackness and colorism. And if you live in the US, then you are benefiting from an economic system that has like kept all the wealth away from black people historically, and a lot to this day as well. If you don't know how, it's easy. There are a ton of GoFundMes passed around every day. Choose one each month and donate something. It doesn't have to be a lot. It's more about the practice and incorporating the practice into your life. You know, you probably know best what you can afford, but you can probably afford something at some point. Like, also, if you live in the US, Canada, or Australia especially, know whose indigenous territory you live on. The website native-land.ca can help with this, and then look into if there's any way you can monetarily support the peoples whose lands you're living on. Yeah, so I know a lot of people who like believe in reparations in theory, but then don't actually like do anything about it. And as if we're like waiting for the government to institute a reparations program, and
Like, I don't think that that's going to happen anywhere in the near future, especially in the US, but there's no reason that you can't be doing it yourself and, you know, creating the change you want to see and all that stuff, all that good stuff.
Community. The last kind of action or principle that I've included for decolonizing is community. Decolonizing alone is one thing, but in community, that's the goal. That's the mood we're all going for. And Clover is actually the one that brought this up to me. Community building and movement is so important. You can understand each other, support each other, call each other in, and level up together. That is the move for 2019, my friends. Stop seeing your friends' successes or growth as threatening and see it as an uplifting of you as well. You can know yourself by the people you hang around. So if all of your friends are really cool or doing really amazing things, you probably are too. And if you don't feel like you are, then, you know, maybe you're not doing anything cool, but it's more likely your imposter syndrome and your insecurity is just telling you that nothing you're doing is worth anything. And that's some bullshit. Maybe, you know, if all of your friends are assholes or racists, then maybe you should reevaluate your life and what you're doing. You can't really have community with people if you're actively benefiting from the other person's oppression and you haven't acknowledged or done anything about it, which is, you know, one of the reasons I talked about reparations before community. Financial reparations are only like a part of that, but I think that it's not a community if you're like actively oppressing someone. The other great thing about community organizing and resources is that as a community, we are alternatives to fucked up colonial institutions. When the white people in my art department chose to recognize a white male artist with the department's like $20,000 grant instead of me, I was able to buy my first camera because of crowdfunding for my friends, and that's made a huge difference for me in knowing that, like, the people that I do my work for and like with most when I needed it were the ones that turned around and helped me and helped me like continue to be able to do this practice that I love so much. And so for that, like, I want to say thank you to everyone.
Decolonizing my art means letting myself be loved in my art, letting my cultures, my traditions, my family, my body to be loved and cherished and praised through my art.
So those were my actions, right? Reclaim your vision, diversify whose work you consume, claim your lineage, reparations, and community building. Note, none of the decolonizing actions that I've suggested are about regulating your work or what it looks like what you're specifically making. Because I think that changing the underlying and supporting habits that shape your work will change the work itself, what your outcome looks like. Because I think that changing the underlying habits of how you generate your practice will lead to new forms, ideas, and content. And if we're obsessing on, is my work like, you know, does my work look political? Does my work like look like this? Or am I doing this with my work, et cetera, et cetera? It's just a way to like stop yourself from making anything and like crush your practice. But if you're like looking around at the underlying habits, at the supporting structure, and you're shifting that and you're rebuilding or building new things, then I think you can find some really important and material changes in what you're actually making. So maybe some of the things I've suggested or repeated are helpful, and maybe not. It's up to you to decide what works for you.
Decolonizing my practice means acknowledging that I am colonized, firstly. Secondly, understanding that a lot of the things that I like come from or were shown to me by a system that benefits the colonizers and not the oppressed. Thirdly, it means to me actively acting against some of those impulses, understanding the complexity of that colonization and its place inside of me, and coming to terms with it, you know, finding peace in myself. It also means understanding the history of those who were colonized and of the colonizers. I think that to fight against it, there are a few things better than educating yourself about the thing or the movement or the action that you're trying to get rid of or fight against. So yeah, I mean, those are things that are kind of off the top of my head.
And originally I thought claiming my sense of self-worth was all about, you know, just being comfortable in my skin, but honestly it's about, I'm realizing now, it's about so much more than that. It's about what they say, you know, being yourself, whatever the hell that means. I think by accepting myself for who I am and by exploring who I am, not casting away those parts of me that seem too weird and abnormal for this world, has been not just given me life, but it's also been amazing for the journey I'm on in terms of my creativity, in terms of my passions, my dreams.
I'll end with this. I think a big part of decolonizing is disordering the center-periphery dichotomy, decentering. Some recentering as a corrective movement, but hopefully a movement towards reciprocity and interdependence and interconnectedness. Colonialism worked by setting up centers and peripheries, the capital cities like London, Paris, or Brussels, where the seat of governments, intellectual production, and the concentration of wealth that had been exploited from all corners of the empires. The capital cities and nations were defined as the center as opposed to the colonies, which were the peripheries. The extraction of wealth, labor, and resources from the peripheries were concentrated in the center, while the ability to narrate reality, to tell the story, was reserved for the center as well, where the stories of the empire would be fashioned and spread throughout. The center-periphery dynamic can be seen powerfully in stories, and is particularly visible, at least for me, in film. The white person, often male, is the center, the hero, the emotional and narrative anchor for the audience in this story. The best friends, the comic relief, the servants, the periphery, those who make it possible for the hero to grow and learn, are the roles that are relegated to people of color. It was through watching movies that I could clearly see what racialized people are in the white imagination. Like, movies are a way to see basically how, like, white people see POC, right? Which is sidelined, the best friend in high school, maybe some other random person who went to school with you, or who serves you in a store, right? The coworker, someone to be amused by, someone to support their successes and mourn their losses. And I say fuck that. But also, watching movies, we internalize these roles growing up as well. The process of extracting this center-periphery dichotomy from our lives and our practice is essential work. Diaspora babe, refuse to live your life on the periphery of someone else's imagination. See the lie. Disorder the structure. Decolonize your practice. Love, Amal. The voices you heard in order were Bushra, Fatem, Alex, Akair, Raphael, Clover, and Bushra again. Thank you so much for contributing. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Wow, it took me a really long time to make this. I've been really sick. I've been sick. That eclipse energy fucked me up, y'all. And it also, like, was a lot for me to think through, so thank you for your patience, thank you for listening. I really appreciate your thoughts and feedback. Feel free to DM me, as you know, at diasporababes, or send me an email at diasporababes@gmail.com. As you heard, you can send me a voice message if you have my number on WhatsApp, or you can download the Anchor app and send me a voice message there, and I can go ahead and play it on the podcast if you'd like. The music you're listening to is by Leila Omaran. Go ahead and check them out on Instagram. And this has been Diaspora Babes. So keep safe, keep faith. Until next Friday.